Welcome to the Authentic Conversations Podcast with Give Impact. Here are your hosts, Liz Ward and Maya Bullock.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast episode number 2 of Authentic Conversations with your local Give Impact team. We are so excited to be back in the recording studio and to have our very first guest of the year with us. We've got Justin Perry with us from Perry Counseling.
Healing and Recovery.
Healing and Recovery. Thank you. And
we are going to talk about prioritizing self-care during unprecedented times today, and thinking about what's working against us in the way that we're thinking. Are we having hard conversations? Are we checking in on our people? And with Justin being in the counseling space, he can give us all tools and just give insight about what he's seeing and hearing, because 2025 hasn't been easy so far. So I'm interested to hear about what you've been learning, but first, we want you to introduce yourself, so I'll pass it to you, Justin.
All right. So, what do you want to know first?
Your name and just where you originally from.
Okay. So, my name is Justin Perry, and I am originally from Charlotte.
Are you a Charlotte native?
I am.
What?
Yes.
He's a unicorn like me.
That's what I was going to say.
As I tell people, actually, I was in a room earlier today with folks who were descendants of the Brooklyn community.
Wow.
And it was a group of about 50 men who meet every Thursday for breakfast. I explained, I'm like, we're not actually unicorns. It's more that other people need to get their circles together so they meet us.
Yeah. Are women allowed? We would love to.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, just love to go.
We're going to have another small world conversation after this. We're working on the Brooklyn project.
Yeah.
I was going to say, This was my first meeting there, so I won't say that you definitely can come there on their behalf, but I think they're open to such things, so I can try to broker a connection after this.
We'll bring coffee, donuts, and the fun.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Wow, okay. So my next question was, how long have you been in Charlotte? So now that I know you're a Charlotte native, that's just awesome. So what made you stay in Charlotte and not, like, venture anywhere else?
Sure. So I remember being a junior at West Charlotte High School, and there was a lot of things that were going on at that time. We actually were in the middle of a court case that was ending school-mandated desegregation. So I'd gone from my sophomore year of high school meeting Rosa Parks because my high school had been recognized as a successful model for desegregation, to the next year, a court case had been launched by a family from New Jersey who didn't understand what we were doing that was ending those practices. And so I knew there was a lot of change happening in Charlotte, and there was something that's now known as CBI, the Community Building Initiative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we love CBI.
Well, yeah, and so originally it was just supposed to be an event. And a friend of mine who I'd known since kindergarten, his dad was going to the launch of this thing, right? He took me as his guest there, and being around all the different people in the room, I saw all the change that was happening, and I made a decision that after college, I was going to return to Charlotte to hopefully be a part of the change and the growth and hopefully be a productive part of it.
Oh my gosh, that's just so impactful. Oh, I did not know that. So thank you for sharing that. I'm all about history. Like, everybody cares about it on our team, but I'm like the one that is like, I want to know everything about this land, this site, all of it. So thank you for sharing that story.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us one thing that is authentic about you that maybe we don't know, or that the majority of people in your life don't know about you?
That the majority of people in my life
don't know? It's okay if they do, because I shared some things last time that, you know, people closest to me definitely know, but
so can I give you two things then? Mm-hmm. That way it'll cover things that people may already know, and then things that maybe other people don't know. So yeah. Something that I think a lot of people do know, obviously I work as a therapist, but I always say before I sat in the chair, I sat in the couch, right? So I actually was a recipient of therapy when I was in college, and that was part of what inspired me to become a therapist. The second thing I would say is that I've had one trip to Europe in my life, and that was when I was in high school. Hopefully, planning to do it at some point with my wife, again, as an adult. But on that one trip, there was a group. We had different kids from around the country, but there was a group of us, a subgroup of us that were black males, and we actually had to, we were in Belgium and kind of got chased through a part of the town by folks with swastikas on their jackets and had to go back to our hotel room just kind of quietly and everything else. And it was one of those things where I actually didn't tell my, I didn't tell my grandmother about that because I didn't necessarily want her to be nervous about it. But I told my parents when we got back and everything. But that is one of those experiences that I remember being something that kind of stood out.
But is it, was it your parents? How did you get encouraged to first try therapy? That's a big hurdle for a lot of people because so many people either have, think there's stigma, and I know that's a big word you guys use, you're trying to break the stigma, but there is sometimes stigma associated with that that creates a barrier, and it takes having someone in your life encourage you to do that and to help make a connection for you. And then I know most people who really give it a fair shot, you know, fall in love with it and realize that it's like an investment in yourself. You're unlocking your best self when you dig in and do that hard work, but it, getting over that hump at the very beginning can be a big thing. So how did, you know, was it after that or who encouraged you?
It's funny, and I'll, actually the word, the use of the word encouragement, actually you'll see why I laugh at it. Actually, I was in what was my first sophomore year at Chapel Hill, and again, that's your first hint. I was in the middle of a rough patch, and I had always been somebody who was very social, somebody who was driven, somebody who had been able to support other people with their problems, but also manage my own with the combination of faith, doing things, and a support system. And for whatever reason, I was in the first period where I could not actually spin myself out of the cycle that I was in. And I would stay up at night. I would sleep during the day. I was avoiding my friends, avoiding my family. I was screening calls. And the only time I would leave my dorm room was to put a hood over my head, go grab food from the dining hall, and return to my room to kind of eat quietly. And eventually a friend of mine pushed me to go eat dinner with her. And we went to go eat. And I told her I'd made a plan that I was going to flunk out of Chapel Hill and transfer to another school because I had made up a plan in my mind. That seemed rational at the time. As an older person, I recognized that nobody really would want a transcript full of Fs as a transfer, but it made sense then. And she just simply said, "Don't you think you should talk to somebody? This doesn't sound like you." And I was like, "Actually, I never even thought about that." And so I went and talked to a dean, and speaking of the encouragement, the encouragement I got was that I had the opportunity to withdraw with school, but I would have to go home, do therapy, come back, take classes in the summer. If I did well in them, I could reapply to get back into school. If not, obviously, thanks for the memories. And so I withdrew. I went home, and I started counseling. I was the first person in my family to go to counseling because in my family, you prayed about it, and you worked through it. You know, that's what my family had always done. And even though my mom, actually, she was a special education teacher and worked at a place that's now Alexander Youth Network, used to be Alexander Children's Home. I mean, she had interned there and everything before I was even born. That just wasn't something that we did. That was not something that was prominent, you know, in my family, but the concept was that's not even what we as black folks do. Like, that was part of the mindset. But at this point, it wasn't so much as an option if I was going to go back to school there. So I started going to therapy. I actually, again, I was still delusional when I started. I was like, I think I might want to do this. And so I was talking to the therapist kind of like, man, I can get an internship out of this. And I remember about a third session, he looked at me and he said, "You're talking to me like we're peers." But we're not peers. You're here because you have a problem, and either you get serious about that or you're wasting both of our times. And so I was like, well, I guess I'm not getting an internship here. But it did give me a chance to actually start looking at myself, start looking at my own people-pleasing tendencies and all of those kinds of things. And I ended up getting a job at a place, United Family Services, answering phones. And they had people there who were clinicians, but they had a degree called the MSW. And I had wanted to be a civil rights attorney. I was all about justice and things like that. And when I looked up the MSW, not only could you do mental health work, but it was rooted in social justice. And so I felt like this is the degree that's made for me. And that completely changed my trajectory. I went back to school in the summer, got A's in classes that I actually went to and did the work, ended up on the dean's list. And every summer I would keep doing work with the United Family Services in Southside and Brook Hill communities. And that kind of guided my path into the mental health field. And I always add that the person who talked to me and encouraged me to talk to somebody is now my wife and the mother of my kids, right? And so for me, when I look at this work, I look at it as there was this very dark period that a lot of the brightest spots of my life have now come out of.
Wow. That sounds like a full circle moment with her now being your life partner, which is really special. And you touching on just like our community as African Americans is typically is more church spiritual prayer that's accepted. And me, I can relate. I'm the first person in my family to go to therapy as well for my own personal healing. So I'm proud of us and to know that I'm not alone in that space.
I love it.
It's about courage.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that and thank you for doing that. And that's, Liz, the point you made about our motto of promote healing and stigma, that is part of the work. And we do go in churches and things like that and realize that it's not an either or, it's often a both and.
Yeah.
Right? That's my other favorite phrase, both and.
So, yeah. I think too, I have a question for you, and yeah. I'm not going to say like I was judged, but I definitely got like a side eye when I made that decision and I had to like further explain my choice. My mom was very accepting and, you know, which was nice to be supported. But what was your experience with your family?
So again, there were so many layers because I was already in trouble based on the fact that I had not communicated the fact that I was not going to be able to go back to school up until we're riding back and telling my dad, we need to actually pack up my stuff. We're not actually riding back for me to go back to school. We're riding back for me to move stuff. So again, there was a lot of layers.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, I think as far as the therapy piece, I think it was more of a, this is kind of what you've got to do. I think buy-in came later.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it was, again, I think the process was we need to get things figured out so you can get yourself back on track to go back to school and everything else like that. And then, you know, we really only talked about it in my immediate family for the most part at first. And eventually I kind of let other people know I was not back in school. But, you know, one of the things I'll say when I think about the evolution of things is I think about my grandmother who, she was 95 when she died, right? And I know, you know, again, this is somebody born in the 1920s. And so, in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Bethany to be exact. And, like, the amount of things that she saw, I can only imagine, right? 100%. And, you know, she was definitely church-going woman, known for her hats in the church, everything else. Definitely praying, faith, and everything else. But one of the things I remember is that later on in her life, her saying to me, related to other people that we knew, family, whatever else like that, so-and-so seems like they're going through a lot right now. They're having a tough time. Why don't you talk to them and see if they'd be open to talking to somebody? And so to me, when I see a 90-something-year-old born and bred in the church, faithful Black woman who navigated the Jim Crow South and everything else.
Yeah.
become open to the idea of being supportive of therapy and things like that for somebody in our family and everything else, that tells me that I never believe in the idea that somebody's too old to change, right? And so it's one of those things I always remember that. And anytime anybody comes into my office and they're like, yeah, so-and-so set in their ways, and I'm like, yeah, if you're still above ground, there's always opportunity to evolve, right?
That's so beautiful.
That's such a gem, Justin.
Yeah, when you were talking about that, it made me think about just how important I think the barrier of trust is often something that gives people pause to get on the couch or even to open up when they're on the couch. And I think about the first time I got into therapy was I was 13 and my parents had just divorced and I was struggling and my sister was struggling and we had a whole lot going on. And my mom encouraged me to go. It was actually, my mom was a CMS teacher and they had a special program that was available to teachers and their families to be able to get access to mental health care. And so I remember going down and sitting with this woman. It went terrible. I mean, it was absolutely awful because I didn't get the concept of how can this person who I don't know have any clue about the complexities of what's going on in my life. And I'm not going to be able to make any progress in an hour. They're not even going to be able to scratch the surface or know who I am or know my family or these dynamics. This is going to be a total waste of time. And I was also struggling with, you know, I'm going to have to do this work, but I didn't get myself in this situation. My parents are the ones that decided to divorce. And so I had a lot of anger in that situation. And so it didn't go great. And I then leaned into both my friends and my faith and all that stuff until after college. My dad passed away the year after I graduated. And that was finally the thing that triggered me to give therapy like a full shot, because I really was at, I mean, what you could consider bottom. Like you know, when you go through a major trauma, it's really helpful to have a third party help you see things from the outside. And now that I'm on the, like you said, can now classify myself as an old person, older person, because I've been doing therapy for, I don't know, almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And since that time, and I could see it now as a tool. And I've heard lots of people say, well, they're just going to try and fix me. And it's not about fixing you. It's about giving you a tool. And the language that I've been able to develop by just all those years of talking with someone and the questions they ask, you know, like y'all are there to probe, to listen and to probe and to hold it out there for you as someone who doesn't know us, to reflect back the things that we're saying and help us look at it from a different angle. But getting that trust with someone is a huge barrier. And I have to say major kudos to you because, you know, I reached out to you recently because I had a major trauma in my life, or technically a couple in February. And I realized it was time for me to get back talking with someone. And I immediately just went to your website and found someone on your website. And that helped me build trust, knowing I was like, if Justin picked them, I'm good. I'm good with this. And we had a fantastic, awesome, awesome session. So it was phenomenal.
I love it.
So I'm a big proponent, and we talk about this a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, within our space.
100%. And you hit on something so just meaningful. I think it's something special in having like that third party of someone who doesn't know you at all, that you can just tell anything to in a safe space, in a quiet space, and them to be able to reflect and to ask you questions to make you think about, or even like a therapist has held me accountable. Like one time when I went and I'm like, yeah, my boyfriend said this and I responded this way, and in reflection, he was right in the situation, but it took for her to help me understand that he was right. Instead of him, which he wasn't very happy about. Sometimes
take
you
the
need
win,
that.
Man. Take the win.
Sometimes you need that. So yeah, love therapy.
Yeah.
But Courtney, you have also a journey with counseling too. You haven't shared that with Justin.
I haven't. So my background's in clinical mental health counseling with a specialty in addiction. So my first clinical was actually at the jail in Uptown Charlotte.
Yeah.
Working with women's programming, had the opportunity to do some counseling in solitary confinement, also working with a small group of women who are processing life in prison for murder charges. From there, I went on to Urban Ministry Center, which is now a roof above, and worked with their substance use disorder treatment program for men experiencing homelessness. So did that for almost 10 years. And, you know, as you all have shared, also have my own journey in therapy as well. So as you have said, just having the opportunity to be in the chair and then also on the couch, thinking back to when Maya and Liz, you were reflecting on your first experience. The very first experience I had in therapy was actually as a child. I think I was probably 5 or 6. And looking back, I'm like, I want to make contact with this psychologist and say, I'm so sorry. Because as a 5 or 6 year old, I showed up having experienced some severe trauma. And I did not speak for the first 3 months. And so, you know, I've experienced a time in therapy as the therapist where a client was very upset and didn't speak for about 30 minutes. And so just thinking back to that time, you know, I had always thought how difficult it would have been for the therapist. Now having done my own work, having compassion for that little girl who was severely struggling. But it's incredible, you know, trusting that process. And for those 3 months, yes, it was really tough, but 6 months later, I wouldn't be where I am today without her. So it's incredible to look back on not only my own process, but also to have the opportunity to be on a journey with others. And looking forward to sharing an incredible opportunity that Give Impact had to jump in and help a client I worked with 12 years ago who was on the street. He now has his own apartment. And thinking about his journey, you know?
As of Thursday last week.
Yeah. Nice.
Like, that just happened.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It's amazing. But thinking back to our first conversation, you know, it was, it started with a hello, one that he just kind of looked at me like, why is she talking to me? And just continued to say hello. And then next thing you know, they knew I was going to say it, so they would say it first, and it became a joke. And, you know, here we are almost 13 years later, and it's a bond that'll never be broken. So
I love listening to you talk about all that. I mean, because obviously there's so much intersection, and I've been in addiction work as well for, so I've been in the mental health field for just over 20 years, and then addiction work since, I guess, about 2008, so about 17 years. And, and I was at Anuvia and other places, so I know Roof Above. And
you have to have had cross paths.
I know.
Then.
that's what I was listening. And you know, when you talk about that childhood experience, it definitely resonates. My first job after undergrad was at a place, Thompson Child and Family Focus, right? And so, again, I always tell people that the children I worked with had experiences that made Law and Order SVU look like the Disney Channel, right? And so what I learned, you know, very early, and my mom was a CMS teacher as well, so it was BEH back then, Behavior Emotionally Handicapped, was the designation. Now it's under the EC umbrella. But one of the things my mom talked about was not engaging in power struggles, because lots of times, if you've experienced a lot of trauma, one of the things you're looking for is a sense of control, right? Because I have so many experiences where I've lost control. So even if it is sitting silently in this office for an hour, that's what it is, you know? And for some of our kids, it's lunchtime. That's fine. Lunchtime's going to be lunchtime, but that doesn't mean I'm going to eat. And I would see, you know, sometimes newer staff trying to get the kids to eat, which, again, it was rooted in, you know, you need food, but not recognizing that their behavior of not eating is, and this is me taking ownership of my body, right? Someone else has made me feel like I've lost power and autonomy of my body, and this is one way I can take it back. And so my mom would always say, don't get in power struggles, and if you do, it better be one that you can win and win it, right? And one of the things that I knew was, like, I can't win the battle of somebody eating. It makes more sense we'd understand, what is this rooted in anyway? You know, what is it that's driving you to sit silently? What is it that's driving you to not eat? What is it driving you to throw a chair? You know, because until we can get underneath that, we're just kind of putting temporary band-aids on what's more than likely a gushing wound, right? So,
go ahead. Sorry, I was going to say, listening to you and Courtney speak, I just commend you both so much. I know as a child or as a growing adult, I wanted to do art therapy with children as a career because art was always like my outlet as a child, I guess subconsciously dealing with trauma. And I decided that I wasn't strong enough to go that route to do social work or therapy, to sit in front of children, to hear their stories, and for me not to be affected or to not cry, because I know you have to hold a certain posture in those spaces. So I just commend you both for your strength and doing that work, because we need it. We need people like you doing that work.
Thank you.
Thank you. I accept that. And you are one of the strongest people I've ever met.
Thank you.
And there's nothing in this world that Maya cannot do. You have been one of those people for me. It is not a degree. It is not the letters behind your name. Mm. It's who you are as a human being. Mm. And the human being you've been to me is someone who is so incredibly genuine, kind, passionate, and keeps me accountable, honestly, for alignment, for taking care of myself, and for loving myself.
Thank you. You did the same for me, too.
And what you just said, that you're a human being, like, that just made me think about, I've had a couple conversations with people since we did our first episode. They're like, oh, you're doing a podcast? Like, what's it about? I'm like, well, and they're like, wait a minute, you're not just talking about housing. I thought you guys just did like housing work. But the reality is we were formed because we want to make our community a better place. And so Justin, when you said that earlier, that's why you came back to Charlotte. You wanted to be a part of making Charlotte a better place. That's why we're here. That's why I stayed. And so our work is not just about creating housing units. It's about reaching people, making people, helping people to be more whole versions of themselves, reconciliation, facing traumas, like working through this, like creating safe spaces for people to be in. And it takes all sorts to make that. And so, I don't know, I'm just really excited to be around this table right now.
I just thought of something, building a safe home within yourself.
Mm-hmm. 100%. I think for me, when I started therapy, I think I was 20. I had just moved to Charlotte, and I was having some dreams come up of things that happened to me when I was 6. And I couldn't quite shake it. So I felt like I needed to talk to somebody to help work through that. And it was really helpful. And I obviously did my research to like find someone who is good with people with anxiety and like all the things. And I think it's important to not just go to any therapist, like do your research and find someone who would be a good fit for you. Mm-hmm. And really read their bios, because everyone offers something different and has different expertise. So don't hesitate to take care of yourself. Whoever is listening, if you feel a nudge within yourself, in your soul, or just if you're seeing signs or hearing things from other people and you feel that nudge, like take it. It's there for a reason.
Well, that makes, Justin, can you talk for a second about if we did have somebody listening that's like feeling that nudge, where do they even start? Like it's so overwhelming to try and, especially when you're in the thick of something, to like even try and figure out how to navigate. Like, how do you find somebody?
Yeah. So beyond giving my own website, as an MBA would do, I'll operate as the MSW first, right? And, you know, I think, so Psychology Today is a website that is a nice general website that will, literally wherever you are in the country, you can look up on there, and psychologytoday.com, and you can look under zip codes, you can look under what you're trying to address, you can look under coverage, all kinds of things like that. And that can be a place to start. You know, again, I have to say my own website, you know,
simply
it's justinperrycounseling.com. So again, all one word, justinperrycounseling.com. What I always say, you know, when Maya was talking about bios, part of, you know, the bios that we have on our website, one of the things that I thought was important was to do things a little bit differently. And while I want to make sure people understand what you treat, skill sets, and things like that. I also did, you speak to the human part, wanted to give a little bit of insight into the humanity of each of us. And so one of the things that I challenge any of people on our team to do is to put a little bit about some of your own experience, as well as moving into, you know, what drew you into this work and then what you do. I push back against the idea of doing no self-disclosure. You know, I think if we're going to destigmatize mental health, then we actually do have to normalize it in our conversations, right? It doesn't mean that I'm going to sit down, if I were working with you, Liz, and say, today, Liz, you're going to help me work through my problems, right? That's when self-disclosure is a bad thing. But I think being able to say, hey, I had this struggle when I was in college, or hey, I lost a parent, this happened to me, or hey, I'm somebody who is LGBTQ and was separated from the church, and this is how I worked through it and everything. Like, there's a lot of different things. Or, hey, I've just dealt with addiction from seeing it with my family, and then eventually in me, I worked through this, and these are the things that I do to help my clients. To me, I think it's important for us to shift this conversation to one that is, we don't have to whisper about it. Right, yeah. You know, like if I tear my ACL, you all are gonna see me, on crutches, mm-hmm. you know, with a cast or whatever else on the air brace, and it's gonna be like, what happened? Yeah, I was thinking my body was still 16, and now it's 43, and I tore my ACL. Right, yeah. With mental health, I think we have to get to the place, even in the same way that we've made strides even with breast cancer, right, with wearing pink and things like that. My imagination is the first person, most likely first woman who dealt with breast cancer probably suffered in silence with shame, mm-hmm. right? But we've worked to actually say, hey, you know what, let's bring survivors together and then create an opportunity to thrive and bring an awareness, but also an opportunity to see us as full people. And so to me, part of our movement is to try to shift the work in mental health in the same direction so that we really build community and connection and break down this mystery behind it. But the last thing I'll just say is that if somebody did call our practice, because again, we can't serve everybody, yeah. right? Our motto is we care first that you get help. Like, we'd love it to be with us, but even if it's not with us, we'll do what we can to help you get connected to somebody else who may be able to help you.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Well, and I will say, I think that sometimes people get surprised when they just, someone starts being open about something. They often can find people in their sphere who are interested in talking about that thing or may mm-hmm. be able to relate. And sometimes it just takes someone being first yep. to be willing to be authentic and to talk about it. And I'm laughing because yesterday CMS was closed. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you got impacted by that too, yes. because of the wind dangers and trees and all that good stuff. And so I had coordinated with one of my daughter's friends' parents that we were going to take the girls for the morning and they were going to take for the afternoon. And I was telling her how glad I was that we were able to work it out because mm-hmm. I had a therapy appointment. Right. And I really didn't want to miss it. And she was like, oh my God, I'm doing therapy too. Like, we can talk about real things. This is great. Let's right. go deep. And I'm like, awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And we spent some time talking about how our parents' generation really struggled with being open about that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. Like, it just was it was taboo or, sure. You just didn't, but I feel like our generation or generations now, I mean, in their 30s and 40s and 50s are really willing to embrace it, more than ever before. And maybe still not as much as it should be, but, I'm excited about that.
Yeah. I think we're definitely making strides and, you know, you mentioned those things that, like, again, the layers of it, I do different things with men, and we do, you know, some of what we call man up sessions, and it's a part of the man up thing is reclaiming what that means, because for most of us, man up meant don't cry, stuff it, pretend like there's not an issue, right? And we have these cliches, people say things like men are rational, women are emotional, and I'm always, so I will start off the initial session and always say, and I'll say that, and I'm in a group of men, and everybody's kind of like, yeah, this is what we all know to be true, quote unquote. And so then I pivot from that and say, all right, so let's stick with that for a second. Let me ask you, who leads, you know, in death by suicide? Men. Who leads in death by homicide? Men. Who leads in death by heart attack? Men. Who commits the most mass shootings? Men. Who has the most widespread substance abuse challenges? Men. And then I always say, some of those sound emotional. Do they sound emotional to you all as well? And everybody's kind of like, yeah. And I'm like, the truth is, we are just as emotional. We're just not given license or skills or the opportunity to practice constructive ways of dealing with that emotion. And so we're really working at even just shifting the dynamics there, because again, even if I don't acknowledge my struggle with my mouth, often it gets acknowledged somehow with my body, and whether that's outward or whether it's inward, it comes out in some fashion.
Absolutely. That exact topic, and you guys have heard me talk about this, where I was walking with my husband, I think this was like a year ago, and we were going through a hard, hard situation, and we were talking, and he was like, gosh, everybody in our friend circle, they all have it together. Nobody is struggling with these things. And I looked at him like he was crazy. I said, are you kidding me? So-and-so has X, Y, and Z going on. So-and-so has ABC going on. So-and-so. And I just started rattling off all of our friends and all the things that I know that they're struggling with. And he looked at me incredulously and was like, how do you know that? So what do you think women do when we get together? Book clubs, lunches, like we're constantly getting together because we talk about the things going on in our life. And he just was like, men aren't encouraged to do, we are not shaped to do that. Or what's the word I'm looking for?
Definitely not encouraged, and that's not the culture we're brought up in, right? Like, and there's a reason why women on average live 7 years longer than men. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think and the thing is, it's a across the board dynamic of why that plays out. I mean, the reality is, a man is, you are taught to carry enormous amounts of stress without breaking a sweat. Never let anybody see you sweat. And again, whether that's in the business world, whether that's in the dating world, whether that's on the sports. But either way, again, and this is obviously recognizing again, as a married mother, like the reality is women carry a lot of things quietly as well, but at a minimum, there's opportunities for expression with each other, yeah. Right? Ugh, whereas yes. For men, it is discouraged to even acknowledge that you're struggling because that's seen as a weakness, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, I say we have a bar menu of emotions. We're not allowed to have the full menu. Like, you're allowed to be excited for sports, but if it's uncomfortable, the only thing you're allowed to be is pissed off, right? You can't be sad, confused, scared, or things like that. You can be angry. And so part of the work is giving us a broader range of emotions to acknowledge and then new ways to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So sorry to cut you off.
No, you're fine. I actually wanted to go back a little bit to your experience in Europe, because what you shared is monumental. And with the current state of the world and everything going on, I want to check in on you to see how you're feeling, and the people and the community that you serve, and just the men that you're surrounded by. Like, how are you all doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a multifaceted question.
Yeah.
I would say for me personally, I'll be honest, my approach to this right now is kind of similar to the way I approached the peak time and the initial time of COVID.
Yeah.
And I really kind of condensed my focus, and I do really kind of focus on what's in front of me. And as much as I am aware of various things, and obviously I'm engaged in various things, I really try to condense my focus and my approach to what's in front of me, what I feel like I can impact, and then do things to kind of step back. And so it's helping me stay grounded. Like, I recognize there's chaos all around, and I recognize also there's other things that are potentially on the horizon. I'm never somebody who's in denial about those things. You know, I definitely work with people and have people in my life that are affected by a lot of the things that are happening, you know, in our political climate, policies, things like that. And so a large part of the work that I find myself doing is helping figure out how do we put the Serenity Prayer into play. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're good if I keep talking?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, you know, and I kind of break the Serenity Prayer in multiple different ways. There's the conventional, which is grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
That's my husband's favorite prayer.
Yeah. Well, it is a good one for all of us married folks, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, in practical terms, when I work with clients, we even talk about how do we do that? How do we actually first identify what you're stressed about? And then we go into the second question is, what can I do about it? So again, you're listing what things you actually can do. Then the third question becomes, have I done these things? And so I'm actually looking at the list of number two and saying, have I done this? And if there's something I haven't done on number two, then that tells me what my next step is. But once I've done everything that is on number two, all the things I can do about it, the fourth question is, now what can I do to move on? And what can I do to move on is, what are things that bring me joy? What are things that bring me relief? What are things that bring me happiness, right? And so once I've done everything I can to address this stressor, it is not only my right, it is now my duty to now do something that brings me joy or relief, right? And I don't need to do that with shame because there's other bad things that are happening in the world, because I think sometimes that's what happens is that we think there's too much going on in the world for me to actually have this moment of happiness. And I look at it kind of like interval training. You kind of sprint or run or whatever you do. But then you got to pause, walk, catch your breath, so then you can do the next sprint. Right. And yeah. So I think that's the approach. The other two versions, I'll just say very quickly when it comes to Serenity Prayer is grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the person I can, and the wisdom to know that it's me. Mm-hmm. Right. And so sometimes for me, I have to look at all situations of conflict are not necessarily situations that I myself can actually influence. What I want to do is direct my attention to the ones where I actually can have influence, because I feel like sometimes we do the Serenity Prayer in reverse. We focus on the things we can't change. We miss over the things we actually could change, and we get nothing done. And so what I call that is like the Insanity Prayer, because it just leaves me frustrated, right? And then the last version is the time one, which is grant me the serenity to accept the past that I cannot change, the courage to change the future that I can, and the wisdom to know that it starts today. Right?
Justin, snaps. You're about to bring me to tears.
That's what a good therapist is supposed to do, right?
That's when we know we're doing a good job.
Yeah. If I haven't used my tissues in a while, then I must not be doing my work.
And don't worry, for all those listening, I have full intentions of writing those out and including them in the show notes. So
yes. I guess my last question I had for you, which is perfect, what are your best self-care practices? Like, how are you taking care of yourself in your favorite ways?
Sure. So, you know, obviously, like, applying some of those things that I talked about there, this one's kind of funny and ironic. So sports is an outlet for me. And, you know, somebody's going to say, well, this doesn't sound like a self-care practice. Well, like my son and I, we go to Hornets games and things like that. So you kind of probably need self-care from the Hornets, but that's its own conversation. But for me, it's important to have outlets. But like I said, sports, you know, coaching my kids, even though it's a challenge time-wise, it is fun to do that kind of competing, things like that. Exercising, something I had to do, I remember at one point during COVID, I had to reprioritize exercise. And part of that was just frankly parenting and everything else like that, because I was busy. And, you know, when you're busy with and you're married with kids, I think both parties, you can find yourself feeling like, well, dang it, if I take time to work out if they haven't had time to work out, like, is that going to create some kind of resentment? And luckily my wife and I both have actually, we've kind of taken some mutual steps to, so there's space for both of us to do it. And it's at different times. And so for me, I know the physical activity is important. Getting outside, especially now that, you know, sun's going to change differently, like getting outside and walking, even if it's like 10 minutes, those kinds of things are very important for me. And then secondly, so it's what I need to do, but also what I have to step back from. Like, I'm very intentional about my media consumption. Yeah. I work to stay informed, but not stay submerged, right? Mm. So I am aware of the various things that are going on. However, what I won't do is spend myself in an ongoing cycle where I'm just kind of not even just doom scrolling, but just watching the same stories over and over and over again. So again, I need to know what's happening because I do advocacy and things like that.
Yeah.
But I also have to step back at times.
Mm-hmm. I received that as a fellow advocate. And daylight savings, is that this weekend?
It is.
I was telling my husband, I'm like, I don't do well in colder seasons. Like, my spirit, my body, like when the sun is out or when it's a warmer weather,
yeah,
I seem to like spiritually and energetically do better and feel better,
yeah,
versus the winter time. So yes. I'm really excited about the spring.
Thankfully, yes, we're on the other side of that cold, dark period. And
yes,
but that's another, when we think about other practices that we do, is there's something that, like when we have challenging times, or whether it's personal or at work, or a lot of times we'll just say, hey, we need to go outside and put our feet in the grass,
yeah,
ground ourselves. Like, take shoes and socks off. Like, just go stand out there. Sun on your face, 5 minutes,
yeah,
something. And it makes the world of difference.
It sure does.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Can I add one thing, too? Because yes, I think it's important. I'll say this, too. Again, going back to being a married parent, I think one of the things is also self-care for us is quality time with my wife. And we actually have a circle of friends. My wife and I joke about being in the marriage preservation business, you know, because there's seasons in your life, you know, there's like the whatever, young single time, there's people in relationships, maybe getting engaged time, there can be this marriage time, then there can be this kids time, and then there can be like a season when it comes to divorce and things like that. And so, you know, and we've had some friends, you know, experience that and stay connected in that. But also, I'll say for me, you know, I've also looked at it as opportunities to kind of reset and check myself too and think, okay, what am I actually doing versus what is it that I imagine I'm doing? Mm. And so we do it with our friends where it's like, hey, if you all want to go out, you want to have your kids come over and stay with us, you know, we'll keep them, and then vice versa, mm, and stuff, because it is important, as I tell my kids, it's important that mommy and daddy are not just mommy and daddy, but you can still be boyfriend and girlfriend.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, my gosh. I love that.
Mm. Yo, I feel like I want to talk about this for like 2 hours.
Like all day. All right,
Justin, but you're just going to already have to be in another episode.
Exactly. We have to have Justin back, for
because
sure,
this is so much fun. And I do want to make sure we also leave for folks that, you know, one of the reasons why we wanted to lead off with this topic is that there's a lot going on in the world right now, mm-hmm, and a lot of people are struggling with, how do I set those boundaries? How do I take care of myself? How do I navigate all this stuff? So this is just incredible, and I hope that it's given folks and our listeners some tools that can help encourage them to stay grounded and to be healthy. But I also think about our work, and we're going to have to continue the conversations on this elsewhere, but creating healthier humans really creates healthier communities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we can then have more to pour into other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just always makes me so excited to see people heal. I mean, it made me excited to heal from my own traumas, but healing is just like at our fingertips. It is available to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm just so deeply grateful for the work that you do and your commitment to ending the stigma around this, mm-hmm, and the fact that you've built out this like awesome team, mm-hmm, to be able to help people. Is really, really cool.
Thank you. That's humbling, and I definitely love. I think for me, I mean, even just when you were just talking about having like a great initial session and everything else like that, you know, for me at this point in my career, I still see 10 or 12 people a week and everything else, and I enjoy that work. But I think one of the things I get a lot of joy out of now is knowing that I employ other people who have gifts that I don't have, mm-hmm. and then seeing other people that I know thrive with them, you know. And it's funny because I'll have somebody who, again, like you, who reaches out and they're connected with one of the clinicians, and somebody may send a message that says like, "Hey, had a great first session with so and so," and you know, and then I'm like, "Hey, I know you met with whatever. I already heard good feedback and everything," and it's because it, to me, it just validates. I know I've got great people on there, but what's most important is that people who I know, people who I care about, as well as people who I don't know, are benefiting and enjoying and hopefully growing from the experience connecting and working with people that are part of the team.
I love it. Well, we'll end on this note. One thing that our team does is we pull positive affirmation cards just to get a message of what we need to take with us. Are you open to pulling a card?
Yeah, I might actually walk away with your cards after this is over for myself.
Go for it.
All right, let's see. Now, do I look at it or do you look at it?
Yeah, you look at it. All right. And share if you feel impelled.
I will.
Compelled.
Compelled.
All right. My happiness is a direct reflection of my level of faith in the universe. That's strong. I love this one because I describe myself as a realistic optimist is the way I always describe myself. Like, I feel like I am aware of the range of negative things that humanity can do, but I'm also aware of the level of growth and positive things that humanity is capable of as well. And so, I think this one is an important one right now that, again, it is okay to have moments of frustration, moments of discouragement, all of those things. I don't think anybody should run away from the uncomfortable feelings you may be experiencing, and knowing that there's opportunity for us to come out stronger on the other side and communicate in the same way that Angela Davis, a few weeks ago in Charlotte was kind of communicating to us. And at some point, maybe we will be that communicating to a younger generation as well.
Absolutely.
So amazing.
Thank you so much, Justin, for joining us today.
Well, on that note, I just want to end and remind all of our listeners that until next time, remember, you're worthy.